Peak oil? Nah, I don't think so. Doesn't mean we should stay on fossil fuels as a fuel system, but I think we have an abundance of oil. We'll be back with Charles Schulz and you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Charles, let's take a few moments to talk about the abiotic oil theory, which I believe you do too, I assume.
Absolutely. You know, we can look at space and we find where stars and planets are forming, and there's a lot of methane present in that material. Well, our solar system is probably the same, and a lot of methane would have been incorporated inside the bulk of the Earth, Venus, Mars. All those terrestrial planets we would expect would have petroleum inside, because when that petroleum is formed, it's made through the synthesis of methane molecules being put together under the heat and pressure that exists underground. So think of the inside of the planet not just as molten lava or magma, but as a pressure cooker where petroleum is being made from the methane where the planets were being formed.
Why is oil found only, though, in certain areas? I believe in the abiotic oil theory, but you would think it would be all over the planet inside.
Well, you know what? There's a very good reason for that, and it's simple. When you make oil from methane, you have hydrogen left over, and the hydrogen reacts with the minerals around it. It takes oxygen from the minerals and produces water. Now, the water and the oil are formed in the same place at the same time by the same process, and the water dissolves silica and salts and other materials that are in the magma. Now, this material forms bubbles that are lighter than the surrounding rock, and salt domes are lighter than rock as well. They have a density of about 2.2, and rock is like 3.5. So think of a cork rising slowly through honey. The salt domes and the oil and the water associated with them rise through the magma over the years until they get near the surface. And what we discover is the materials that have separated out from the rest of the material due to their density and the temperature and conditions that formed them.
Explain more.
Well, as the salt is lighter, it rises through the magma, just like a cork rising. And as that happens, there are pockets of petroleum, natural gas, and water associated with those materials.
So what they're finding then, when they tap into this, they're finding the pockets.
That's exactly right. If you mix up a lot of material that's dense and light and then you shake it for a while, it'll separate itself by weight. Well, the material in the earth is moving very slowly over the years, but it has different densities, and the different densities allow the material to sort itself out.
Why would the Middle East have more pockets than some other areas of the planet?
Well, you're going to find places where there's more and places where there's less, but the fact is there's a huge amount of petroleum and natural gas right in the Gulf area of our country. And Canada, believe it or not, has the world's largest reserves of petroleum, not the Middle East. But a lot of it is tied up in forms such as oil sands and tar sands.
Why is it such an emotional issue? The people, I think, who are proponents of the dinosaur plant theory of oil, they get so upset when you tell them you believe that this planet has an abundance of it. They don't listen when you say, I think we need to get off oil as a fuel. They don't listen to that. They just are vehemently ticked.
Well,
you talk about that, why?
They've got two big issues to overcome. Number one, a lot of them have degrees and have done a lot of research in this, and that invalidates a lot of the work they've done. If you find out that everything you've studied for is wrong, or at least a lot of it is, you don't feel so good about the money and the time you spent learning.
It's like religion.
Well,
some
you know,
of it, not
you
all of it, some of
belief.
It. See, I have to put my caveat in there, qualify that.
Absolutely. But the other issue is this is their bread and butter. And they're all over the world. They've got huge, huge resources to deal with. And when you start cutting back on the sales of oil, if you make it sound like it isn't this rare gold-like material, there's more of it than you'll ever possibly be able to use, their prices could fall.
Exactly.
They lose control.
It's what De Beers is doing with the diamonds.
Oh,
same
yes.
Thing. They're controlling supply and demand.
Well, it's all about control at this point, control and economics. And, you know, the funny thing is people are just finding out we can now manufacture better diamonds than you'll ever find in nature and cheaper.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, this is the funniest part of it. Did you know that they're making heat sinks for semiconductors and specialty equipment out of diamond now?
Yep.
Because it's cheap enough to manufacture.
Do you think some CEOs for the oil companies also believe in the abiotic oil theory and they're just merely saying, We're not
they
saying anything about
they
it.
Have to. They have to. If they're honest with themselves and they look at the science and technology, they've got to know.
Yeah, maybe so. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Hello, Don. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Hi. Good evening.
Hi, Donald.
Good to hear you. Charles, I've been waiting to hear your Mars report. I heard you on a couple of years ago talking about this fossil research on Mars. Mm-hmm. And was wondering when the where we can get the pictures, where we can get your books. And also wanted to point out, I had a friend out of JPL, which I talked to. He just left JPL last year. Mm-hmm. And whenever they got into the discussion of life, they wanted to keep quiet and didn't want any discussion of it. They actually kind of got mad if anybody wanted to talk about it.
Oh, they've and got I a have, long, long history of that. Yes, please continue.
So I was just curious why that would be, especially since it looks like this is going to give you pretty much proof that there's has been life on the surface of the planet. And what's going to happen to our own space program right now with the budget cuts and the on-off business of starting a program, canceling a program, and so forth. As the Russians are now building a complete new space base and the headquarters for astronauts and everything, and the Chinese apparently are building a new rocket which is bigger than our Saturn V.
Oh, so, absolutely, yes. You know,
so I'm wondering what's going on. Now, I'll leave for the phone now and listen to your answer on the radio. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The Russian Space Agency is building a new facility, a $2.7 billion facility up in Siberia. I think it's in the Vostochny area, not far from China. And the Russians are cooperating with the Chinese on space flights at this point. They're providing some of the infrastructure, and they're working together. There's a bit of a rivalry going on right now between China and India. They have a bit of a space race going on. But Russia and China are planning a Mars mission as well, and it's going to happen pretty quickly. The Chinese have an unmanned moon mission scheduled this year and a manned landing for 2017. So, you know, we're not getting any of these things done, but they have a lot of ambition. They have the funding to do it, and they're going to do it. We can stand by that.
Well, you know what? I do think space should be cooperative, don't you?
Well, it should. It's gotten us the greatest yield. And but, you know, the reason they're going now is not just for weather satellites and not just for tourism. They're going to mine the moon for helium-3 for nuclear energy. They're going to be using it for fusion reactor fuel. And the other issue, the Mars Fossil book, quickly I'll touch on that. It's available on my website and on Amazon.com. Look up the Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars or go to the link on Coast to Coast to Shelf's Laboratories. There's a splash page for both books, Fossil Hunter's Guide and The Living Galaxy.
Charles, what do you doing now these days, by the way? Just writing or what?
Well, I'm doing a lot of writing, but most of my work these last few months has been in industrial automation. I'm working with companies that produce environmentally friendly materials. I do a lot of the robotics, animation, the automation for industrial production systems, and I'm doing research and consulting as well.
Go ahead.
I've got a couple more books in the work, one on the coming events for the new virtual world, the singularity, if you will, and another one on how to solve the world's problems.
What's the next Facebook? Facebook, Twitter kills MySpace. Facebook has hurt Twitter. Facebook is way on top. What's after that? There'll be another fad.
There will. And the thing is, social networking sites have become the big thing. People want to connect with a lot of people, but the issues are those of privacy and spamming and a lot of things you run into. People are becoming very distrustful of some of those things. It's hard to say what the next social networking phenomenon will be, but I do expect they're going to be something like personal agents that wander the web for you, gathering your information. I think that's going to be a big issue right there. But if I knew what the next one was, I'd probably clam up about it and invest in it.
And wait, huh?
That's right.
It's like a nightclub, though. You know, nightclubs are very busy until the next new one opens, and then everybody goes to that.
Well, everybody likes novelty. Everybody likes something new and different, and they want a different twist on things. So whoever comes up with something similar to Facebook and Google Video, and it has something different that engages people, I'd say that would do it. If we had the equivalent of robotic actors or avatars in locations around the world, and we could log in and use them over the internet, then you'd have an instant hit. Imagine being able to be a tourist in France just by putting on a headset and some gloves. That can be done. We have the technology for it.
Next up, we go to Milford, New Hampshire. Sharka, it's your turn. Hi, Sharka.
Hi. Good evening, everybody. I have two questions, if I may ask.
Sure.
Just through listening to this. First of all, to touch on the oil part of it, one of the things I was wondering if it's the reason there is abundance of oil is because I would like to make an analogy. The earth is like a living thing, and it is sweating. As the, you know, continents and subcontinents grind together, they produce oil rather than sweat. That would be my theory why there will always be an abundance of oil as long as there's tectonic activity. That would be my first point. And
as long as the planet keeps working out sweating, we're okay, right?
We might have to send it to the gym. My original question was this. While I was listening when you were speaking about Mars, this is for Sir Charles, please. I'm just wondering, you know, the whole theory about why the dinosaurs disappeared, could it be that something that was carried in here from Mars or from some other place that was organic somehow destroyed the dinosaurs, and perhaps some other of the other planet's creatures had some kind of a way to protect themselves, but the dinosaurs did not? Could that be a plausible theory?
Well, you know, we look at, I don't know if you're familiar with the iridium metal that they found all over the planet. Whenever material from space enters the atmosphere and burns up and puts dust in our environment, we can see that there are certain products of that that are not very common on the Earth. And iridium is a metal that is very rare on the Earth, but quite common in meteorites. They found a crater in the Gulf of Mexico area, near Chicxulub is what it's called, and it's at the Yucatan Peninsula. And that area dates to 65 million years ago, the same time the dinosaurs died. And at that time, at that same date in all the fossil records around the world, there's a layer of this iridium metal in the dust. So they're pretty certain that a meteor struck the Earth, or a very large piece of asteroid, and killed the dinosaurs because of the climatic changes and the terrible heat and dust generated in that explosion. So the dinosaur deaths most likely were caused by a giant asteroid impact back 65 million years ago. But it's not implausible that a rock from Mars could have carried an organism that infected something, and that could have happened a number of times. There are many things that we see in the fossil record that we can't entirely explain. Many of them seem to be tied to impacts or volcanic events, but some could very easily have been tied to climatic shifts or even an organism being brought from somewhere.
Interesting. Charles, what is NASA doing for growth of the future? What are they doing?
Well, that's very interesting. You know, right now, NASA's projects are kind of on the back burner. It seems a lot of things are not happening. You know, the Ares didn't go anywhere, the new moonship. And they've actually, they're contracting with Elon Musk at SpaceX to do the crew orbital transport system. So Elon Musk is going to be carrying astronauts pretty soon for NASA, from the look of things, which is a very positive thing. I mean, if you mass produce your spacecraft and you do it commercially, you're generally far cheaper than a government agency knocking them off one at a time. But they do have exploration missions going to Mars. We mentioned the rover briefly, the Mars Science Lander. And basically that is a rover the size of a Mini Cooper, 900 kilograms, or about 2,000 pounds. It's about four times heavier than the existing rovers. That's one of their big missions. They've got the Stardust 2 catching comet material. There are a lot of different things that NASA is doing, but a lot of it doesn't make the news very easily. And it's a shame, because one of the best NASA commercials I ever saw was a remix of some things Carl Sagan did, and it was very inspiring. They have the capability of being a truly amazing organization and recapturing their lost glory, but I don't know if we'll see it happen in this economic environment.
All right, we go to Dayton, Ohio. I'm first-time caller. Hi there.
Hey, how are you fellas doing tonight?
We're okay. I hope you are too.
Yeah. All right. Well, my question is actually the speaker tonight. His name is Charles. Yes.
Yep. You've got him.
Charles. Yes.
Okay, Charles. You speak like no other human I've ever heard in my entire life.
well, thank you. I
just want to know. Yeah.
We're not sure he is human, are we, Charles?
Yeah, I think he's got that stem cell too. I need that. I need some new lungs. I was born with asthma, but that's aside for it. I want to talk about the solar energy that you were talking about. You know, you mentioned very, very briefly, and the spaceship technology space ferrying technology via the sun.
Yeah.
And what was the light coming up our driveway and just turned off? All right, that's weird, but
do we have a question here, Ron?
Yes, yes.
Go ahead.
Where was I just 3 seconds ago? Because I can't answer that. I'm sure you gentlemen can, of what sentence I said before the light, because there's a car just pulled into my driveway.
All right. Whatever you're doing, be careful.
Okay.
And whatever you're doing, be careful.
Well, if it was a question about solar-powered space travel, that's actually pretty simple. Right now, spacecraft depend on rocket fuel, which is an explosive material. If we were to move the source of energy from a solid or liquid material to the sun, we capture the sunlight and use it as the energy to drive your spacecraft, we can eliminate most of the mass that a spacecraft would have to move, and we get the ability to move all over the solar system very cheaply and easily.
What is going to be, though, the next incredible propulsion system that, if there are ETs, I believe there are, what are they using?
That's a very good question, and there's been a lot of thought and speculation about it. Now, since we don't know if there have ever really been aliens visiting the Earth, a lot of people have seen things that lead them to believe so, and a lot of things. People have experienced things, and I won't dismiss their accounts or what they've seen and experienced, but travel between the stars is either going to be faster than light or slower than light. And if it's slower than light, then we expect ships to take generations to get there. And they'll probably be crewed by not necessarily living organisms unless it carries a whole population or they're in hibernation, but probably machines or some hybrid of the two. If we are having faster than light travel as a real possibility, then the way to do it would either be through wormholes or some way of manipulating the shape of space itself, or use of negative energy to remove the mass of a spacecraft so it could travel very quickly. There are a lot of proposed methods of doing it, but at this point of the game, we don't even have a physics theory that allows us to even begin to experiment with such things.
Well, that's true too. But somebody's going to break through with incredible propulsion.
Absolutely. Something we've never thought of.
Yep. Next up, we go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes. Hi, Charles. Hi. I'm an amateur astronomer. I know a lot about space and astronomy. Two quick questions for you. Question number one, the Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity that you mentioned. Question number one, will that hopefully have a microscope, preferably an electron microscope, that could look at a sample of water added to the soil of Mars to see if there are, it looks like, living organisms moving around in the small area? And question number two, do you think that with Barack Obama's recent State of the Union address about infrastructure building, could there be a space infrastructure building in which we move ahead further with the Ares 1 and Ares 5 and the crew exploration vehicle, at least to a greater degree, and go, if not to the moon, to a nearby asteroid, eventually to Mars, as well as the moon?
Okay, great questions, both of them. Number one, on the Curiosity rover, they do have a microscope. It's not an electron microscope that I'm aware of, but they do have a modification to the optical microscope. They have white LEDs, and they have the ability to take full-color images, and they also have ultraviolet LEDs, so they can do fluorescence studies on some of the microscope samples. Now, the microscope that they have is more like a powerful hand magnifier, so there are limits to how small it can see, but this one will be far more capable than the existing microscopes that are on the microscopic cameras on the rovers that are on Mars right now. Phoenix had the most amazing technical hardware in terms of microscopes and detection ability, and the Mars Science Lab will have far better chemical detection. They'll be able to detect water directly with some of the equipment they have, and that's a real plus because the existing rovers didn't even have any means of detecting water, even though it was built as a follow-the-water mission. In the infrastructure building issue...
Let's get that when we come back, Charles. We'll take care of that one. We'll be right back. Hey, if you'd like to send an instant message to me, then simply click on the Fast Blast link at coasttocoastam.com. You'll find it right at the top of the homepage. It's right up there. The Fast Blast user interface now has been fully integrated with the website, so it's up to 3.0. And we'd love to use your Fast Blasts for questions and instant feedback as well. So don't forget, Fast Blast, part of coasttocoastam.com. Charles, do you think we'll find anything just startling on some of these other lands, these other planets?
I'm sure that we will. I know there's been some discussion lately of the possibility of life on Titan, that cryogenic moon of Saturn that has the very thick atmosphere of methane. And they've also, of course, found that there are lakes and rivers there made of methane and ethane liquid. So, you know, they've got volcanoes on that little moon, and they're driven by liquid water, not by rock, because in that sort of an environment, ice is a mineral. So it's quite possible there are organisms that live in that environment in the volcanic areas.
What about Europa?
Europa is one of my favorites. Between Ganymede and Europa, the two larger moons of Jupiter, you know, two of the four, there are oceans below the ice from all appearances. And what strikes people the most who've done the research is the color of the light coming from those two moons matches the color of bacterial growth on the Earth. So there's a very good signature right there that there could be something living under the ice, at least microorganisms.
Okay, let's go to some other calls. Let's go to Kat in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Kat, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. I hope the New Year is treating you well.
So far, so good.
Okay, yes. This question is going to be something that's in an article in the Kansas City Star regarding stem cells for joint replacements. And if I can read just, not the whole thing, just 3 to 4 sentences of what this young guy has done and is doing, and then the 2 sentences that bear the question of what technically, it's very technical. If you could say, what does it mean that he's actually saying? This is the Kansas City Star. You might want to jot this down. Monday, 24 January, 2011, page A4. The title is Seeking a New Way to Get a New Knee. It's a man, a young guy named James Cook. He watched his grandfather get crippled up until he was in a wheelchair. So he said at age 8, he vowed to become a doctor or scientist and fix it so no one would ever have to suffer through what his grandpa did. He's a professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Missouri. The goal is to put metal and plastic joints out of business, and his concept is biological cartilage specifically grown from the person's own stem cells outside the body.
Absolutely.
For insertion to the knee. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry, because there's one more sentence and then the question. Did you need to say something?
No.
Are you there?
We're waiting for you.
Okay, yes. Cook, 45, has performed the procedure successfully in dogs. It's the result of 11 years of work. It was written up in the medical journal The Lancet. And then here's the question. He's working with a guy from Columbia University called Jeremy Mao, and then Clemson University Lab. And this is the quote from Mao. The work reported in The Lancet represents the first time that an entire articular surface of a synovial joint was regenerated. This was accomplished by the homing of the body's endogenous stem cells, another first. Can you tell us all what that means in layman's terms?
Sure. Basically, what's happening is you can send messages to certain cells in your body and make them turn into stem cells, and you can direct them to their destiny. You can tell them what to become. And so, in essence, what they're doing is they're programming cells and tissues in your body to grow new cartilage, and the cells target locate where they're supposed to be, they home in and they repair that area. Now, the problem with cartilage, as many people are aware, is cartilage doesn't have any oxygen or blood flow through it, so it heals very, very slowly. And in experiments about 30 years ago, they defeated that to a degree by routing blood vessels in the area so there would be oxygenated blood, and it would help the cartilage heal 10 times faster. Well, now this is obviously far more superior. So basically, with a simple procedure, you could tell your own cells to grow a new knee joint. So the only issue you have the cells had their biological clocks turned back so it'll last as long? Because every time a cell divides, it uses up one more division that it's supposed to have in its lifespan. So that was the only thing that I would be concerned about in such a regrowth.
Do you think stem cells will be the where-all for medicine?
No, actually, I don't. I think they're the learning ground.
Really?
We're learning. Yes, we're just deciding what we're going to do with the technology because a lot of people aren't aware of other advances that are happening. Stem cells are where we're learning how cells become what they are and are directed to repair things. If you can tell a cell how to reset its biological clock, something in the telomeres, that's one place it is, and something in the mitochondria, that's another place. If you reset those clocks and tell the cells what to be, you could literally have an unlimited number of new cells. And that could be done through the use of nanotechnology rather than actually injecting cells in your body.
Okay, next up we go to Trini in Canada, east of the Rockies. Hi, Trinity.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I'm glad you mentioned nanotechnology. There was what I would call a soundbite on TV just tonight, yesterday actually, that mentioned the fact that they had found some kind of nanotechnology little device that was like the size of a postage stamp, it looked like, that would be perform more power than wind, solar, and it would also help as far as, solar, wind, power, and for invisibility cloaking.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear about this?
Actually, I have, and there are a couple of interesting things happening there. Do you have a specific question in mind?
I just didn't. It was, like I said, it was only a soundbite, so there was no information. They just said, this is what we found, and this is the device, and then it was gone. They told me nothing more about, well, what exactly this is, or is it possible, or are they using it, or you know, what is, you know, where they're at with it, or anything.
Okay.
There was no more information.
Yes, absolutely. MEMS is an acronym. It means micro electromechanical systems. And basically what it is, early on when people wanted to make very tiny machinery, they would use the same methods they use to make semiconductors and wafer fabrication. They would etch tiny little components and then cut them free so that they could move around or make arms or levers that would move. Now, we use MEMS technology in many places, and much of the stuff is built into analyzers the size of a postage stamp or a glass microscope slide, where you can put a tiny sample of a biological material, and the MEMS devices will act on it and allow you to manipulate it and identify what it's made of. Advances in MEMS technology, which is getting very close to nanotechnology. It's big and clunky compared to nanotech, but it's getting us there. Advances in this technology could allow us to harvest energy from other places, and that's one of the applications of MEMS. You actually could make tiny little levers that generate power as they vibrate from movement or heat. The cloaking effect, many people are aware that we're working on various forms of technical cloaking or invisibility. It's been achieved in the radar bands very, very easily, and now they're working on optical cloaking. What this does is it generates an effect where you literally can bend the light waves or radar waves around an object so it literally vanishes and you see what's behind it. And there are some real advances going on in that field. A lot of it, of course, for obvious reasons, is not talked about, but it's happening.
Charles, a little controversy tonight. Hubble may have found another galaxy. They call it a faint, fuzzy blob that may have started 480 million years after the Big Bang, which they think is a landmark galaxy detection. Some others are saying, no, that's not the case.
But it is
dramatic.
It is dramatic, and that says that optically we can get information from 13.2 billion years ago. That's very near the beginning of the universe. I think the controversy comes from the fact that people aren't sure of exactly when galaxies began to form, and the reason for that is simple. We accept the temperature of the sky as what it is today. But when you cut the size of the universe in half, the sky temperature goes up roughly 8 times. When you go back to the beginning of the universe, the sky was very hot. If it was, the sky was so hot that water could not exist or freeze, the formation of planets and stars changes radically. So we're going to see very early stars and galaxies have somewhat different properties from the ones that exist in this era of the universe's existence. So it would be very interesting to study what they see there and see what they find.
What's the next evolution beyond the Chandra X, which was launched in 99?
You know, that's basically the X-ray telescope, and they use what's known as Gray's angle optics. They have it's difficult to make a lens for X-rays that's lightweight and portable, so they used the edges of surfaces to reflect the X-rays and collect them. They're working on new telescopes that will do other things. X-rays are a very interesting thing. Cosmic rays are a wonderful place to study. Deep infrared is another. There are bands that we can't see on the ground, bands of energy and parts of the spectrum that are invisible because of the atmosphere. So anything you launch into space gives you brand new windows, new eyes to deal with. I believe that there is a telescope they're working on that may have the ability.
It's the web, right?
Well, absolutely. And the ability to detect particles such as neutrinos and cosmic rays would be next.
Yeah.
Some of that data is being used to look for dark matter, by the way.
That one's going to be launched in 2014. And I bet by the time they launch it, it'll already be outdated.
Well, you know what? The old phrase is, if you've got something that works, it's already obsolete.
Yeah, no, that's true. Will we ever get to the point where they will see the earliest formation of the Big Bang. I mean, if Hubble can find 480 million years before the Big Bang, what will an instrument like the James Webb Space Telescope find?
Well, what we're going to be able to do is push the limit back farther and farther. There was an early period of the universe where the sky was not transparent, where it was glowing with energy and particles. The prize would be to be able to see that moment in time. Think of it as a bubble surrounding our universe of almost 13.7 billion year old light. And that energy, that's the microwave background of our sky right now. It's shifted down so far in temperature and energy. But if we could see that, we could see the very beginning of the visible part of the universe. Then we could start getting a better idea of how the galaxies formed and clustered the way they do today.
In your opinion, what did the universe look like prior to the Big Bang?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question. There may have been no prior. You know, some people theorize that our universe is embedded in a much larger, higher dimensional universe mm-hmm. that has billions, trillions of other universes like clusters of grapes sprouting from it all the time, and everyone could have a different set of laws of physics. But without the ability to travel there, it remains theory. But it's a fascinating theory.
What does it all mean?
You know, I don't know if there is a meaning from the way we take it. It could be something that we're incapable of understanding.
It is so bizarre, isn't it? When you think of it, Charles, that, you know, we could have multiverses, we could have zillions of life forms like ours.
Well, I think it's a natural outgrowth of logic and thinking and all of the science that we've done, that there could be uncounted numbers of universes. I mean, if you think about it, there could be anything you could ever imagine in any quantity you could ever imagine anywhere in the universe and outside as well.
Prior to the break, you were just about to talk about an infrastructure question.
Yes, indeed. Obama and building infrastructure. You know, I think that the real big issue here, as far as space goes and our exploration, I know there have been a lot of budgetary cuts. We don't really invest a lot of money in infrastructure. When you look at the bailouts that were done at the beginning of his career as president, we put a couple of trillion dollars out, and they really didn't help things much. They went to banks and, you know, auto companies and things that on the surface seem to do some good, but I haven't seen a whole great deal of rebounding in the economics. I think putting money into things like that does more harm than good. We need to let the system settle and find its own balance. But when we go into building infrastructure, what exactly are we building? We should be repairing the bridges and highways that are falling apart and building new power plants, and I really don't see much of that happening. A lot of our stuff is being shipped out to other countries, and that's what's destroying our economy.
Let's go to Duluth, Minnesota. David's with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just lucky to be on the show. I do agree with the news thing that Charles said, was that the information that you get is not actually what really matters. I mean, you get your local news, you get the national news, and the things that you guys are saying should be a mandatory thing on a science class in high school to get people interested in doing the things that would perpetuate the interest in science. But the thing that I wanted to ask the question was is that about this Mercury spinning and glowing as far as energy goes and doing levitation, and I want to know more about that. And I don't know if Charles has anything to say about that.
I haven't done a lot of research on it. I've only heard in passing about experiments with cryogenics and mercury metal. You know, whenever you have a metal that is chilled to a very low temperature, it can often become a superconductor, and I believe that's what they've been doing. And superconductors have the ability to expel magnetic field lines, so it's easy to levitate them. I will have to look into that and find out more. I don't know exactly what's going on that field. I've been so busy, unfortunately. I try to keep on top of everything, but it's not really humanly possible.
You know, I remember during my days in science class, physics class back in high school, at that point, there were no other planets discovered beyond our solar system. Things that we were taught was based on what they knew then. I bet now it's amazing what they're teaching in school.
Well, you know, it's surprising. When I had young children in school, I found out that they really didn't teach them very much differently from what we knew, and a lot of it was actually wrong. We went around and around with teachers over things like that. I was infamous for sending notes back to school. But you know what? There's a great deal of more information out there, and easy verification can be had. You just have to be able to be smart enough to filter out the garbage from what's on the web.
Butte, Montana. Larry, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Larry.
Thank you. Sure. Yeah, good evening. My hats are off to you folks for putting real and reality show. So thank you for that. I guess I got two quick questions. One, did you hear that Bill Clinton, former president, is in Saudi Arabia going to put a spin, a positive spin on the contact with extraterrestrials?
No, I didn't hear that.
I haven't heard that either.
Yeah, it came out on Twitter today.
Well, don't believe everything you read on those things.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. It sounded like a great forum to address the public with, you know. And the other question I had was on chemtrails and if that's a no-talk thing or what you might suggest to gain knowledge in, I don't know, whether they're magnetizing, you know, the atmosphere. Like, magnets seem to be a big topic in hovercraft and stuff, but I thank you.
Okay. Well, I can't tell you a whole bunch about chemtrails. It's not something I've researched. I know that I worked with a lot of different aircraft in the past in aerospace, and we didn't inject anything in the exhaust. I know there's been a lot of controversy about chemtrails, and I think that if people suspect that there is such a thing, go out and get one of these chemical collection kits and put it out around your place and see what shows up. Yeah. That could answer a lot of questions pretty quickly and simply.
We've had many shows, Charles, about chemtrails. Something strange is happening out there. I don't know if it's weather mod or not. What I find fascinating, too, is people would laugh years ago when you would tell them, you know, we are controlling the weather in some cases. They are modifying it. And
well,
now
sure.
Companies are coming out saying, yeah, we've been doing this. We did it in Abu Dhabi. We're doing it here. It's real.
Well, back in the 1950s and 60s, it was quite common to use silver iodide to seed rain clouds because the particles were very tiny, very cold, and they would nucleate raindrops. And so it was called cloud seeding. We don't see any of that anymore, and I don't know why that is. Perhaps they're worried about the effects the traces of chemical might have on the environment. However, we did do some research with microorganisms that could change the patterns of rainfall and freezing. There's a bacterium that grows on potatoes called Pseudomonas syringia. And it forms ice crystals when the temperatures drop. They did some gene modifications on them and found that the change in the proteins on these bacteria would prevent them from freezing the potatoes when freezing temperatures developed. So they were actually accelerating the formation of ice crystals. Now the question is, what do they do in the atmosphere? Do they help nucleate snowflakes and raindrops? And I don't think anybody's ever really gotten an answer to that.
No. Next hour, we'll take final phone calls with you, Charles. And I do want to take some time to talk with you about intelligent design. You ready for that one?
Certainly.
I want to get your take on that, especially with all the things we've talked about tonight about real science. Charles's website, SchultzLaboratories.com. I'm not going to even spell it for you. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. So you can go and hook up right there and see some of his works, including The Living Galaxy and A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. I'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.